Revised Thought Verses. Who was Prentice Mulford? Prentice Mulford was born at Sag Harbor, Long Island, New York, the 5th of April, 1834, and he was the sole author of the entire series of the White Cross Library publications. He died the 27th of May, 1891, while in his boat, which was drifting off Long Island. He was 57 years old. There was no body with him at the time of his death, but it appeared that his passing was during sleep and was unaccompanied by pain or distress. He was reclining upon his improvised couch in the boat, wrapped in his blankets. The awning was properly fastened, and everything was in order. He had been dead for 2 days before he was discovered. There was no indication of suffering on his face, nor was there any sign of previous excitement or agitation. It was as though he had just left. And, as it has been said of him, if Prentice Mulford could have chosen the manner of his death, I think he would have elected to go as he did. In 1856, in his 22nd year, Mulford sailed to California, where he would spend the next 16 years. During this time, he spent several years in mining towns, trying to make his fortune in gold, silver, and copper. Then, after leaving the mining life, Mulford ran for a position on the California State Assembly in Sacramento. Though he was nominated, he ultimately lost the election. He returned to San Francisco and began writing for a weekly newspaper, The Golden Era. Mulford spent 5 years as a writer and as an editor for various papers and was named by many San Franciscans a bohemian because of his total disregard for money. Mulford said, "Poverty argues for us the need to be in possession of more brains." He became known for his humorous style of writing, his vivid descriptions of mining life, as well as life at sea. In 1872, in his 38th year, Mulford returned to New York City, where he became known as a comic, lecturer, an author of poems and essays, and a columnist for the New York Daily Graphic. And all this spanned, 1875 to 1881, his 41st to 47th years. Mulford was also instrumental in the founding of the popular philosophy called New Thought. And his book, Thoughts Are Things, served as a guide to this new belief system, and is still a popular work today, 2016. He also coined the terms the law of attraction and the law of drawing. The story of Mulford's life as a journalist and author is told in his own words, as follows. "I drifted gradually into the occupation of writer, and I never wrote a line for publication until I was 29 years old. I wrote because I could not help writing. I found a pleasure in putting my thoughts down on paper. It also seemed an assistance to thinking more clearly. We may think more things in 60 seconds than we can write out in 60 minutes. The time occupied in putting our thoughts down on paper seems as a sort of governor to regulate the outflow of our mental stream or ideas. If you could do this without the aid of pen and ink to keep from thinking too fast, you might live for hours in an extemporaneous poem or fancy or fiction of your own." The first article that I ever had published appeared in the columns of the Union Democrat of Sonora in Tuolumne County, California. It was an account of the yearly fall spree held by the river miners when the Tuolumne rose in its wrath 2 months earlier than was expected, 5 years out of six, and swept away all our summer's work, dams, flumes, wheels, sluices, and other river mining machinery. It was not so much an account of the spree as of the results of it and the feelings, mental and physical, remorse and repentance, contrition and headache, that was realized the day after it all happened. The article struck a sympathetic chord throughout the entire county. 4/5 of the population had been there themselves. "I wrote this sketch one Sunday afternoon, under a big pine tree, near my cabin. It was in a little gulch, and through the gulch flowed a little brook. 100 yards distant, the muddy current of the Tuolumne roared and rushed and bowled through the willow bar and over a prosperous claim. There came floating, in its current, a log, or part of a flume, or a sluice box, or a smashed water wheel, which the mad river tossed about as if in derision of man's puny work, and perhaps flung it upon a half-submerged rock and crashed it to splinters. I know not why, but the picture of the birthplace of my first article has remained firmly imprinted in my mind. For about 3 years between periods of prospecting, mining, teaching school, running for office, lecturing, and organizing gigantic, ruining enterprises, all of which perished prematurely, I wrote almost gratuitously for the Democrat over the signature of Dogberry. By that name, I became pretty well known in Tuolumne and the adjoining counties. I had no ambition to become known as a writer. My highest aspiration was to possess a gold claim, which would pay at least $4 or $5 a day. And as my aspiration increased, my daily income of such diggings drastically diminished. At last, my income descended to the scale of 75 cents per day. And all my worldly goods were an old gun, a saddle, a pair of blankets, an enfeebled suit of clothes, and a trunk with abundant room for the many things not in it. At this crisis, in the early fall of 1866, in my 32nd year, I received an unexpected letter from Mr. Joseph Lawrence, publisher of the Golden Era, which was at that time the leading literary weekly paper of San Francisco, asking me to take a place on it. To San Francisco, I went straightaway, and a more forlorn and seedy specimen of literary impecuniosity never set foot in that city. Mr. Lawrence placed me at one of the leading hotels where he lived, and by the agency of some fresh apparel, he made me more presentable. I felt very much out of place among the stylish people with whom I now found myself. However, I filled my position on the Era, I believe, acceptably. It was only at certain times, with a pen in my hand, that I felt raised above my average shabby, unassertive mental level. I was called modest and retiring. But that wasn't really correct. I was, in fact, cowardly, and I thought almost everyone that I met, and who had a pretentious air, was in some way unknown to me, my superior. Bret Harte had, at that time, a local California reputation. And so had Mark Twain. I frequently met both of these gentlemen in the Era's office. I also met Charles Warren Stoddard, Ralph Keeler, who died so mysteriously in Cuba. I also met Newell or Orpheusker, Artemus Ward, Ada Menken, and several other bright people who were regular or occasional contributors to the Era. I remained on the Era for about a year. Mr. Lawrence went to the Eastern States, and I left the paper soon after his departure and sustained myself on a meager income by peddling my contributions to various papers. I wrote a good deal for the Dramatic Chronicle, which was a theater program sheet about as large as a bandana handkerchief. And I also wrote for the Seedling paper, which its publisher, Charles de Young, founded in 1869 or 1870, and was called the San Francisco Chronicle. De Young was always predicting that he would start a great morning paper. Almost everyone laughed at the idea. But one morning he did start it. And then they stopped laughing. One morning, while correcting my proof in the Chronicle's dramatic composing room, the building commenced shaking. It shook and shook, and then it shook harder. It generated a general tendency on the part of the printers and the editors to steer rapidly for the stairway. I went with the rest of the staff, being at the rear. That was the great earthquake of 1868, and it took place in my 34th year. I was the first to go back to the office, and it looked as if it had been emphatically, industriously, and elaborately struck by lightning. About 3 minutes later, A pale and scared compositor put his head in at the door, and seeing me, he exclaimed, "Great gosh, did you stay here through it all?" Inadvertently, I said, "No." But, with more presence of mind, I might have said, "Yes," and thereby may have gained a fine and fleeting reputation for courage. In 1868, in my 34th year, I had to call to edit the Stockton Gazette, a Democratic campaign paper. I obeyed the call, ran the paper for 5 months, was well paid, but got tired of the job, and retired back to San Francisco, where I skirmished again on the ragged edge of a decent living, by throwing in contributions wherever they would be accepted. In the latter part of 1872, in my 38th year, an inspiration seized me to go to England, to advance, by writing and talking, the good and glory of California. I raised about $500 from the businessmen of San Francisco by representing to them the profitable possibilities of my self-imposed mission. I raised the money in about 48 hours. Additionally, Ralston, the noted banker, handed me $100 in gold after a curt and crusty interview of 3 minutes. It was like bearding the lion in the big banker's den, but the lion came down with the dust, and I left the den, shaking and perspiring with the agitation of the interview. But the 5 gold 20s were in my fist. The San Francisco Bulletin also engaged me to take a certain amount of correspondence from England. So, to England I went, and I did the best that I could in writing and talking about California wherever I found opportunity, in cities, in towns, and in villages. And I think I did, indeed, earn my $500 advance wages. I spent 2 years there, returning in 1873. However, one of my greatest troubles was the English chairman. One cannot give a lecture there without a chairman, and the chairman must also be somebody of importance. The English cannot hear anybody without a chairman, and the peculiarity and infliction of the English chairman is such that he will make an overly long speech in introducing you and telling the audience what you are going to say, so that by the time he is through, most of the wind is taken out of your sails, and the audience just wants to go home. In 1872, in my 38th year, during my England project, the Bulletin made it an object for me to visit the Vienna World's Fair. I stayed there 2 months and returned to London with $4 in my pocket, thanking my lucky stars that I had run the gauntlet successfully of the many languages I encountered at different railway stations, and had not by mistake got on some train which might have landed me penniless in Turkey or in Siberia. I returned to America in 1873, in my 39th year, bringing with me only $9 and a wife. After some months of misery as an occasional contributor, the San Francisco Bulletin sent me as a correspondent to the Centennial at Philadelphia. I forgot to say that I operated the preceding winter, 1873, in New York, as a weekly Sunday evening lecturer on various and sundry descriptive topics. This was an occupation that brought me fame, rather than bringing me new shirts. Once, during this phase of my existence, I preached from a Unitarian pulpit, but not acceptably. They never called for me again. Soon after this, destiny placed me on the editorial staff of the New York Graphic. There, I suggested the condensed column of local and general matter, under the title of History of a Day. It was just what the paper wanted, because their illustrations took up so much room, they had not much left for local news. Mr. David Crawley was the managing editor, and a very good one too. One morning, while on the Graphic, I found on my table a letter from the Bulletin, asking me to serve as their Paris correspondent at the exposition of 1878. In 48 hours I was on a French steamer. It was my 44th year. Returning after a 6 months' residence in Paris, I resumed my former place on the Graphic as the head reducer and condenser of news. I filled that position for 6 years, and then I left it in 1883, in my 49th year. And this was because of being thoroughly sick and tired of chronicling, in short meter, day after day, the eternal round of murders, scandals, burglaries, fires, accidents, and other events which people deem it indispensable to know and to swallow after breakfast. I became so thoroughly saturated with the horrors consequent on civilization as to feel, some mornings, after I had stewed the preceding day's miseries down into a small mess, that I wanted to go for a dose of arsenic, a razor, a pistol, or Paris green myself. Paris green is a highly toxic emerald green crystalline powder that is used as a rodenticide and as an insecticide. So, out of consideration for my sanity, if not my life, I left the paper because they would not let me do anything else. I then retired on a very small fortune and built with my own hands a ramshackle shanty in a New Jersey wilderness, 17 miles from New York. It cost $40, and it was not an elegant piece of architecture, but it filled the bill. There, I commenced writing my White Cross Library series, and this was still in my 49th year. I went to Boston in 1884, in my 50th year. And it is, for some mysterious reason, necessary to go to Boston to start any new idea or movement on this planet. There, I started the White Cross Library. I had just enough money to print the first edition, but I had no subscription list at all. However, I had faith in my ideas, and I have more faith now, and expect to increase it in the future. That was in May, 1886, my 52nd year. From that time forth, means and agencies have come right along to further the business, which is and has always been on a self-sustaining basis. Prentice Mulford passed away on the 27th of May, 1891. He was 57 years old. What others had to say about Prentice Mulford. From the Union Democrat of Sonora, California, the 6th of June, 1891. Prentice Mulford, the well-known journalist and who formerly edited the Democrat, has gone over to the majority. His body was found in a boat at Sheepshead Bay, New York, last Saturday. The boat contained provisions and cooking utensils, thus showing that he had started on a cruise. Mulford was a shy, sensitive man, a fine genius who never harmed anyone by deed or by word, and whose memory will ever be kept green in golden land. The following is from Judge Farrell in the Union Democrat, also dated the 6th of June, 1891. More than 30 years have come and gone since the writer first met and began a lifelong friendship with Prentice Mulford. We were both young and scarcely more than boys. One, the teacher of a village school, and the other, the editor of a country newspaper. Both commenced writing for the press about the same time. There were many things in common between us. We belonged to the same political faith, loved the same friends, wrote for the same newspaper, the Union Democrat, and shared the same hopes and aspirations of journalism and life. Now, after so many years, upon glancing at a newspaper at my breakfast table, I read the telegraphic announcement, "Prentice Mulford is dead." Prentice Mulford was a strange and peculiar man in many respects. His early ventures in the field of literature are well known to the readers of the Union Democrat, whose hair has silvered with the frosts of years. At one period, the pen name of Dogberry was as familiar in the southern minds as that of Bill Nye today. But the style, the thought, the expression, the pathos, and the humor belonged to Mulford alone. After coming to San Francisco and connecting himself with the Golden Era, published by his good friend Lawrence, his contributions were then written in his own name. pushing his fortunes eastward, Mulford wrote for the press in New York, and he visited England and France as a correspondent. Finally, he became connected with the White Cross Publishing House in the Empire City, and remained with it until death snapped the brittle link of life. Brain and pen were always busy. He was a man of thought, a thinker, and one who refused to take his ideas of life and death secondhand, but delved for himself in the minds of speculative inquiry. Mulford respected no creed or dogma because of its age, and he rejected no doctrine because it was the butt of scoffers or the target of ridicule. He believed that this life was but a few days' journey towards a higher and better development. He had a philosophy and a religion of his own, which was recognized and shared by many at the time of his unexpected departure. He believed in thought force as the controlling factor of human action, and he voiced with Bulwer that there is no such thing as death. And he felt with Shakespeare, life is but a walking shadow. And he calmly and fearlessly sought to read the mystery of the future beyond the grave. Death had no terrors for him. Just as the poor little worm changes from the mire and ugliness of earth to its bright winged life, as a butterfly of great beauty whose home is in the air and whose life is amid the perfume of flowers. So too did Prentice Mulford anticipate the last great change from life through death to that higher and brighter life, eternal in the heavens. Prentice Mulford, in the White Cross Library materials, expressed an original thought and a peculiar force of expression, which will live long after many of the famous men of today, 1891, are dead and forgotten. Upon his recent visit to California, both before and after he had been up to his dear old Tuolumne, I enjoyed the sweet satisfaction of his company upon several occasions. I found my good old friend little inwardly or outwardly changed, so far as I could judge. Time had dealt kindly with him, and had left untouched the merry twinkle of the eye, the quiet pleasant smile, and the genial laugh that was so natural and infectious, and to hear it was to laugh again. Though he was a deep thinker, his honest, comely face was not pallid with the cast of thought. He had much to say of the old times, the old friends, and the brave, glad, and joyous life of the early days in California. That was a time when the world seemed young and in its prime. His heart was full of the scenes and memories of the pioneer days. The names of the living and the dead were often upon his lips. No unkind recollections appeared to have an abiding place in his tender heart, and all his words were words of pleasantness and peace. Well, Prentice Mulford is dead. He has passed from earth and gone out with the tide in his boat, and drifted away from us who loved him here to those who love him still in the world of immortality. Long had he looked forward to the great experiment, but never with a heart that faltered or a mind that doubted. He expected to hear cheery voices from the other shore and look again into the special eyes of the loved ones who had gone on ahead. Goodbye, old friend. May the breath of summer sing to the stars of your goodness, and may the snows of winter fall lightly upon your last resting place. San Francisco, the 2nd of June, 1891. Robert Farrell. And from Eliza Archard Connor, following Mulford's death. If the late Prentice Mulford had singled out from all his writings just one sentence that he wished to stand as a memorial of him and of his work, it would have been this: thoughts are things. There is, in us and around us and throughout the entire universe, a subtle thought ether which is visible in veiled glimpses now and then to those whose clairvoyant eyes have been opened to inner realities. And carried upon this ether are the vibrant waves which carry thought, imagination, and vision to all mankind. If a man thinks, he forms, and he projects out from himself on the thought ether actual images and things which float out beyond him and are caught with other thought waves and images which then directly react back on the man himself. Moreover, just as we send out upon the vibrant ether, we likewise receive from it also. Like attracts like. Reaction must equal action. And thought, good or bad, must rebound upon the thinker, also good or bad. Thus, if a person becomes discouraged, hopeless, or broken down in their thoughts, that kind of vibration will be drawn to them upon the thought ether. Thus, the more they indulge in a discouraged, grumbling, hopeless mood, the harder it will be for them to rise out of their dark condition. Indeed, there are some people who experience images and pictures of their thoughts flashing before them, especially when they were in a peculiarly quiet mental condition. In Prentice Mulford's view, the space all around and above us is peopled. There is nowhere in nature or any expanse that is unpopulated, or where there is nothing but air. And in the hollow sphere above us, which is invisible to the physical eye, traumas are enacted, battles are waged, and mighty thought movements are begun that are afterwards manifested here among us in the world of physical matter. However, above all things, and before all things, we have to remember that thoughts are things. This is the meaning of the biblical saying, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. The inner man, the spirit self, the fourth dimensional self of each individual, is made such that it expresses itself in the physical body. Thus, our physical bodies, their beauty, or their deformity, their sickness, or their health, are only the outward expression of an inward beauty or deformity, sickness, or health. We are what we think. Think thoughts of health, joy, prosperity, goodwill to all mankind, and in time, there will come into our lives the same health, joy, prosperity, and goodwill from that which is around us. If you persist in keeping the image of success in your mind, never giving up, but thinking buoyant, hopeful, and happy thoughts, you will draw unto yourself success in business or in any other enterprise. Associate yourself with successful and fortunate people. Get into their atmosphere. Wear the best clothes you can afford, no matter how poor you may be. Spend your money judiciously, instead of hoarding it. And it will then return unto you with significant interest. So, putting out the atmosphere of success, you shall draw success unto you in return. I have thus emphasized and dwelt upon this phase of Mulford's doctrine because it was what he himself constantly dwelt upon and emphasized. However, he taught much more besides. He was also the founder of a system of philosophy, profound and far-reaching. He seemed to absorb what suited him from ancient philosophy, Christianity, Buddhism, and spiritualism, and to reject the rest. That's what everybody ought to do, regarding the world of thought and belief. Only take what suits the individual's case, and to take nothing else just because they are told to do so. Thus it was that Prentice Mulford incorporated this independence of thought in his life, as few others have ever had the courage to do so. He believed thoroughly in reincarnation, which is that ancient doctrine that is now penetrating the new thought of our time, 1891. In his heart, I am sure that Mulford believed he could trace himself back to at least one former existence. He also believed, most thoroughly, in evolution, not for a few centuries, but for ages. In its spiritual and physical ascent, mankind has now just reached the lower rungs of the ladder. Centuries will pass. Men will grow finer, gentler, kindlier, and more beautiful as they assimilate more and more of the collective consciousness with its collective potential through the formless substance. Their food will become less gross, they will become less coarse and selfish, and their bodies will grow delicate, beautiful, and have unlimited vigor and longevity. Disease, sin, and suffering will fall away like a worn-out garment, and we shall stand forth at last as splendid, shining spirits, as our true fourth-dimensional selves, and in the full flower and glory of the experiential unification, which is the aim of our self-determined incarnations here. In the physical realm, we incarnate over and over again so that we may personally experience that which we are not, and thereby we unify that which we are with that which we are not until we reach the fullness of the collective consciousness with its collective potential. As the human race develops its spirit, its fourth dimensional nature, Mulford postulated that there would be less and less of the heavy physical parts that decay. Consequently, illuminated by the collective consciousness with its collective potential, and through the formless substance, we would be free from disease or wasting cares, which we would, in the course of time, learn to eliminate from our lives. Thus, Mulford reasoned that we might stay here, in this life, for as long as we chose, and that the transition to the next stage would no longer be the violent, terrible wrench that death is now, but merely a gentle, mysterious change, if indeed there would be any change at all, with the evolved spirit bodies, that thought force, and the formless substance would build for us. Prentice Mulford loved the sea, as so many other philosophers, poets, seers, and dreamers loved it. And, if he could have chosen the manner of his own crossing, I think he would have elected to go as he did go. He died alone, in his boat, on a Long Island bay, and wafted back to the infinite, upon the bosom of the sweet, green, restful sea. Eliza Archer Connor. End of Who Was Prentice Mulford? Thank you.